This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Even before the war, food prices globally were somewhat on the upward trajectory. Drought in South America, high demand in China were among some of those factors that were driving prices up. And it seems like those will continue to prevail.
That's economist Wandile Chilopo, who focuses on global food prices for South Africa's Agricultural Business Chamber. Details coming up also. Tigray's People Liberation Front says it is being attacked by Ethiopian and Eritrean troops. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization says food prices, which spiked this year because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, are beginning to drop. Russia and Ukraine are major producers of agricultural commodities such as wheat and sunflower oil and traditionally feed large parts of Africa. But experts are warning that in Africa it is too early to celebrate. Darren Taylor has more.
The UN agency measures monthly changes in global prices of five food commodities: cereals, dairy products, meat, sugar, and vegetable oils. It says there have been significant drops in costs of oil, wheat, and maize, mostly because of a deal which resulted in Russia finally allowing grain exports from Ukrainian ports. Economists say the price drops provide relief to people in wealthier nations, but aren't significant enough for poorer regions like Africa, where a lot of basic foods remain out of reach to millions.
Even before the war, food prices globally were somewhat on the upward trajectory. Drought in South America, high demand in China were among some of those factors that were driving prices up. And it seems like those will continue to prevail.
Economist Wandile Chilopo focuses on global food prices for South Africa's Agricultural Business Chamber.
Yes, we will see prices coming off from around about the intense war levels, but we're not going back to the pre-war levels in the near term. We have to consider also the lag between the agricultural prices and what people pay in the retail prices when we think about food prices coming down and the other costs baked onto that, like fuel and the others. So I would say food price inflation in general will remain elevated, even though we will see agricultural prices somewhat softening from levels we saw around about April, March or so.
Chilopo says food prices across much of Africa continue to rise, in some regions by about 10% every month. Analyst at South Africa's Economic Justice Group, Mervin Abrams, says inflation like this is literally killing Africans. He says what's happening in South Africa mirrors the situation elsewhere on the continent. Abrams's group measures the monthly cost of about 40 food products needed by most households, such as bread and cooking oil.
That basket now stands at 4,775 rand and 59 cents. And now that is about a 12% increase on last year. It is a 534 rand and 47 cents increase year on year in rand terms. That is having a massive impact on households. The cost of this basket of food already outstrips the kind of wage that about 50% of working people in South Africa bring into the household.
Chilopo says high fertilizer prices and weakening values of many African currencies also mean food prices aren't dropping as much as is needed.
We could see the headline food price inflation, which is the rate at which prices are rising, softening somewhat for much of the second half of this year. But going into the retail stores, looking for that decline on prices, you have to look into some time next year on seeing some bit of softening on some of those products, particularly vegetable oils, to an extent around about the grain-related prices, where we hope to see much more
Good news, says Sikhlobo, is that the worst price hikes are over, and he hopes that more stability in global food markets will eventually result in food becoming cheaper across Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A UN monitoring committee is urging Benin and Zimbabwe to address alleged discrimination against minority and marginalized groups in their countries. The committee released findings this week on progress in seven countries whose records were under review. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination expressed regret that Benin's National Plan of Action Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Intolerance has been only partially implemented since it was adopted in 2014. While discrimination and hate speech remain prevalent, mainly against albinos, the committee said few people have formally complained about the crimes. Committee member Pansi Tlakula surmised it might be due to lack of awareness of available judicial remedies, lack of confidence in the justice system, or fear of reprisals on the part of victims. She said people with albinism are most victimized by the discrimination that pervades the society.
In our interactive dialogue with Benin, the committee raised concerns about reports that people with albinism are often subjected to extreme physical attacks, stigmatization, and discrimination based on beliefs related to witchcraft and skin color.
The committee urged Benin to take effective measures to protect people with albinism from such vicious behavior and to ensure they have equal access to education, health, and employment. Regarding Zimbabwe, the committee said it was pleased with the positive measures taken by the government to implement the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. However, Tlakula said the committee was disturbed by reports that atrocities committed during the Gukurahundi violence of the 1980s continue to be a source of ethnic tension. Around 20,000 Ndebele-speaking people were killed in Matabeleland and Midlands provinces by government forces in the 1980s. Tlakula said many victims remain traumatized. She said the committee is concerned that they are barred by state agents from participating in mourning and commemorative activities.
It urged Zimbabwe to take measures to ensure that mourning and commemorative activities can be conducted without restrictions or threats. It also called on the state party to ensure that the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission fulfills its responsibilities to provide a platform for post-conflict public truth-telling.
The committee also criticized the widespread discrimination against people who work in the informal sector or as domestic laborers, noting most are Black women who face low wages and work in dehumanizing conditions. The UN experts requested Zimbabwe amend its labor laws to end discrimination on the grounds of race, class, and gender. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zambia's president, Hakainde Hichilema, has pledged to improve the country's financial situation after it received a $1.3 billion bailout from the International Monetary Fund. Zambia was the first African country to default on its debt in the COVID-19 era, as Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's African News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
President Hakainde Hichilema, speaking Thursday at the launch of plans aimed at boosting the country's socio-economic development, said the IMF Executive Board had approved a financial assistance program for Zambia.
They approved our extended credit facility for this great country, whose greatness lies ahead of us. And for us to make our country greater, we have to do what is necessary in all the areas.
The $1.3 billion bailout is aimed at kickstarting the country's economy and restructuring its debt, The plan allows Zambia to immediately access $185 million. The financial assistance approved on Wednesday will give Zambia room in the budget to increase social spending and strengthen governance. The framework of the bailout will require the country to improve its public financial management. According to the Zambian government date data, the country accumulated $31.74 billion by the end of 2021, of which $17.27 billion was external debt. Nearly one-third of the debt, $5.78 billion, is owed to China. In November 2020, Zambia was unable to make its payment on a €42.5 million bond, becoming the first African country in the pandemic era to default on its debt. In July of this year, the Southern African nation cancelled projects worth $2 billion to prevent its debt from further growing. In July of this year, the Southern African nation cancelled projects worth $2 billion to prevent its debt from growing further. The country plans to increase copper production to 3 million tons a year in the next 10 years and produce foodstuffs for export in an effort to reduce its debt. Ichilima says his government will have to make tough choices for high economic growth.
The macroeconomic objectives set out in the 8th National Development Plan are to place our economy on a higher growth trajectory. No question about it. That's the agenda. Next, to restrain fiscal deficits that we experienced in the last 7 or so years to a point where we failed to live within our means and defaulted on our obligations.
Ichilima said the country must depart from rampant corruption, overvaluing the government projects and failing to finish them on time. He pledged to reduce domestic debt and inject money into the economy. Zambia's next step is to sign a legal non-binding memorandum of understanding with the G20 Bilateral Creditors Committee, which is intended to assist countries in resolving their debt. The authorities hope to complete discussion on the memorandum by the end of 2022. The G20 refers to the group of 20 large economies. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Tigray People's Liberation Front says Ethiopian and Eritrean forces launched a large joint offensive against TPLF forces in northwestern Tigray. TPLF spokesman Kende Gabrahiwot told the French news agency AFP the attack was coming from Eritrea. News organization said they cannot independently verify the claim. Fighting between government forces and the rebels resumed last week after a five-month lull, dashing hopes of peacefully resolving the nearly two-year war. Combat had been concentrated around the southeastern border of Tigray. Reuters News reports that the Ethiopian government says attacks by Tigrayan forces had intensified, leading to the deaths and displacement of civilians and property destruction. The government statement did not directly address claims about an attack by Ethiopian and Eritrean troops in northwestern Tigray. Reuters says the Eritrean Information Minister also did not immediately respond to requests for comment. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Vice President William Ruto was declared the winner of Kenya's August 9th presidential election, but opposition leader Raila Odinga is contesting the results in the Supreme Court. As a candidate, Ruto indicated his commitment to building 100,000 affordable housing units for poor Nairobi residents, creating 4 million jobs a year and providing national hospital health insurance for all within his first 100 days in office. Paul Nanatolia, a research associate at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed whether the elected president could deliver on his ambitious promises with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shinawi.
It's difficult to say because three things. One, the Kenyan economy is not doing very well and has not been doing very well for some years. And in fact, Kenya is heavily indebted, the country, and it has not been very successful in rescheduling and renegotiating the terms of its debt repayments. So there's an economic issue that Deputy President Ruto will face if his victory is to be upheld by the Supreme Court. The second problem is that these ambitious promises have been made before in Kenya by previous administrations, including the Moi administration of President Daniel Arap Moi, who also promised in a series of campaigns, 1992, 1997, 2002, of course, the election in which the opposition came into power for the first time in Kenya. Ambitious promises were made, but were not delivered. So he will have a task on his shoulders to convince Kenyans that he will really be able to deliver where other administrations failed to deliver. The third issue, both William Ruto and Raila Odinga promised very, very ambitious populist initiatives, which are largely aimed at young people. Unemployment in Kenya is hovering at 40%. And the young people constitute the biggest chunk of the electorate. Kenya, just like any other African country, is, you know, most of the population is between the ages of 18 and 30. And so there were these populist messages. It is very unclear as to whether the Kenya government, as currently structured, has the ability and capability to deliver on these very, very ambitious programs. So I think these are the three issues that Deputy President William Ruto, if he is indeed declared the winner of the election, will have to contend with.
So how critical is it for the new president to play a strong commercial diplomacy role abroad with the aim of attracting investment into critical sectors such as agriculture and financial services in Kenya?
This is absolutely critical given the nature of the Kenyan economy. Kenya is a regional powerhouse, economic powerhouse in East and Central Africa, and actually even throws its economic weight in Southern Africa. So Kenya traditionally has occupied a very important regional economic position. And so Deputy President William Ruto, just like his predecessors, will be called upon to build and sustain those regional linkages in order to strengthen the Kenyan economy. Kenya does very well outside its borders traditionally. Secondly, on the issue of agriculture that you mentioned, that Kenya does boast a fairly developed agricultural sector, which significant parts of it are modernized. These are modernized agriculture with advanced technologies that are being applied to various agriculture ventures, ranging from milk to corn and other products. So given the difficulty the Kenyan economy has been facing, a future Kenyan president will have to work very, very hard to establish regional economic agreements, to establish regional markets, to attract foreign direct investment. Kenya has been having a problem, especially in the context of COVID-19. I assume that these would be number one priorities on the desk of any future Kenyan president.
That was Paul Nantolia, a research associate at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shinawi. Members of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party in Johannesburg today managed to open access for migrants seeking health services at the popular Hillbrow Clinic after members of Operation Dudula blocked immigrants from entering the facility. The two groups came close to exchanging blows while in Kalafong Hospital in Pretoria, fighting broke out between the two groups. Members of the Economic Freedom Fighters say foreign nationals should not be excluded from getting medical help, but those belonging to Operation Dudula say they should go back to their countries and not crowd local hospitals, a development that has left migrants worried. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
These are members of the Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF, party as they took over the entrance of Hillbrow Clinic, inviting foreign nationals to come in. EFF chairperson in Johannesburg, Avio Mdaniso, told VOA that barring immigrants from accessing the health facility was a ruthless act.
We're the vanguard of Africans. We had to come here and make sure that all the healthcare centers are open. We're at Hillbrow Clinic is currently open and is operating. Everyone, there is no way that we can, after democracy, we can have a situation where people are demanding IDs from people. It cannot be right.
But Operation Dudula members were also there accusing foreign nationals of crowding health facilities at the expense of South Africans. Operation Dudula chairperson in Johannesburg, Sipiwe Shabangu, told VOA that they want all foreigners to leave South Africa.
It's that South Africans, they don't get the basic services, the basic needs that they deserve because of the influx of these illegal foreigners. We're saying those foreigners who are saying are legal, they must go and use private facilities.
In Kalafong Hospital in Pretoria, EFF and Operation Dudula members engaged in first fights over allowing foreign nationals to access the hospital. Zimbabwean national Emmanuel Gift Banda told VOA that immigrants are very worried by the development.
What is happening here is very unfortunate because we are seeing black people attacking other black people. ANC and ZANU-PF is quiet on all of this, are letting us kill each other and they are sitting there watching it.
Health Minister Joe Pahla, who visited Kalifong Hospital, told journalists that the government does not support the disruption in health facilities. Operation Dudula members started blocking immigrants' access to health facilities after the political head of health services in Limpopo province, Poppy Ramatuba, was captured on video embarrassing a Zimbabwean patient for coming to get medical help in South Africa. And foreigner sentiments have heightened since the beginning of this year, raising fears of xenophobic violence. Locals are accusing immigrants of taking their jobs and overwhelming health services. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The UN peacekeeping mission in Mali, MINUSMA, says 50 people were killed in April in an operation by the army and foreign personnel. MINUSMA says the incident happened on April 19th during a sweep of the municipality of Hombari. This after one of their convoys was attacked by a roadside bomb. According to the French news agency AFP, the UN says scores were killed, including a woman and a child, and more than 500 others arrested. Officials did not specify the foreigners involved, but news sources say a Russian advisor deployed with Mali's army was killed in the blast. Western intelligence says Mali's ruling junta has brought in mercenaries with Russia's Wagner group to fight Islamic extremists. Human Rights Watch says in March, the army of foreign forces killed about 300 people in central Mali. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Audrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.